missing after World War I?
After World War I, all of the men who had learned to fly in the war effort, there was just a sudden overwhelming number of men pilots and nothing to do with themselves. Mm-hmm. So that started the barnstorming era. They could buy up the surplus war airplanes for practically nothing, mainly the famous Jenny, the JN4D, and some standards, but the Jennies with the OX-5 engines could be bought for $250, $500 new, and most of them could raise that much money, so they would start barnstorming and or have little aerial circuses and make the county fairs and that kind of thing to keep themselves employed. Because like everyone else, most of them, once the flying bug has bitten you, you're lost. That's all there is for you. Flying is your life, and that's all you want to do.
What is that comparable to? I mean, and what can that be comparable to, that kind of compulsive, that total love and love? I try to think of what I can
Well, compare. I suppose it's the same thing, that same motivation or the same stimulus that happens to a yachtsman or to a horseman who train and breed and race and compete with boats and horses. It's just a consuming interest you happen to have in one particular sport. Or area. But most of the early women pilots were taught by these World War I people who were instructors.
I want to just, before I forget this, when you were talking about barnstorming, I just thought that barnstorming had, you know, ended by the 30s or whatever. It was kind of a,
well,
more
it
English.
Was very much on the wane. It was just tag in by the late 20s. In the early 20s and the mid 20s was the compacted, the barnstorming era.
Well, in one of the articles that I came across, Laura Ingalls had written, it was written in 1936 or 37, and she said that she's talking about barnstorming really being the only way for a person to earn a living as a pilot. And then that was curious to me, because I'd really thought that by 1930 or 32, barnstorming was no more. But I suppose it somehow continued.
Well, you know, there were tag-ins, but it was passé, really. Certainly in the United States it was. And the fact that the World War I pilots were instructors for most of the women who went on to do the flying things in the mid-20s and late-20s and the 30s. We somehow picked up their philosophy, which was natural.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sort of a daring do, in a way, and it was a fatalistic attitude, in a way, because that was their attitude. You know, live today, for tomorrow you may die, that kind of thing. And it probably was a very good philosophy to have for the time. And although we probably didn't know we were absorbing it, we did. Because that was our attitude. The things you tried to do or you managed to do, you just thought nothing of it. You didn't think of it being hazardous. You didn't think of it as being really any great accomplishment. It was just something that if you could do it, it was there to be done, and it was fun to do it. It was fun to get ready for it. It was fun to do it. And after you did it, then you forgot about it and went on to do something else. And it didn't make any deep impression on you. At least it didn't on me.
But to some of the women who get a little caught up in the fame and publicity, some of them, I felt maybe some of them became a...
Well,
and that's a natural thing.
There are all kinds of people in the world, and there were some who went around beating themselves on the chest and got pretty big-headed about it. But that is an obnoxious type. And the public won't countenance those kind of people, and so instead of getting public acclaim for the things they did, they didn't get it, and they just dropped right out of sight.
That's interesting.
The public is a very fickle crowd, and the personality of the both the men and women who were making records and winning races, if their personality was not such that the public would accept them,
They
might as well have gone back and hidden in a corner, because that's where they got pushed.
It seems to me, when I was reading about, you have to admit that for a woman, for anybody, sometimes I'm talking about just to get up in one of those planes in 1909 when it was just the most precarious thing in the world.
Well, apparently those gals who flew at that time were really very high type persons, well educated, intelligent, and some of them were quite high on the social ladder.
There's a certain courage.
Definitely, and of course it was just. Well, extremely unusual, and the public, in fact, just flying was.
Right, much less a woman who had a certain
thing. And when a woman was brave enough to fly those airplanes, of course, they got a tremendous amount of attention and through the media, mm-hmm. But then the men did too, but always, I think, women got a little more than men did because they were women. So you see, there, and all that was true up until World War II, until the 40s. So there were advantages to being a woman, as well as disadvantages to being one.
Newspapers.
And it all kind of evened itself out, I guess.
What, if these women, you're saying you adapted the qualities of the philosophy that a lot of the men had, but would you say that the women that were flying in from 1909 through your era had certain qualities that first of all drew them there and kept them there? I mean, there was a certain something that you all had in common. It was a certain...
Not exactly. Beginning about the mid-20s and carrying through the late 20s and, in fact, through the 30s, there were an awful lot of women who wanted to get into flying simply for the glory they could get out of it, or the anticipated glory, or the anticipated publicity. In fact, a lot of would-be starlets who wanted to crash the movies tried to use that, use flying, and took up flying for that purpose only.
Is that why Ruth Elder got so much criticism?
But they, I mean, they soon dropped that.
Is that why Ruth Elder got so much criticism?
That's right.
Because they felt that she wasn't sincere. Did you know her?
Yeah.
Did you think that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was so obvious. You can tell when people love flying. Mm-hmm. And you can tell people are only using it as a stepping stone or something.
George Haldeman seems so terrific. So I was...
He is.
He's got sort of... He must have liked Ruth, and I felt that it was a chance for him also to make a name by flying across the Atlantic with her. And
well, I think it was through Ruth that they got the money to do the flight. But Ruth herself at that time had very few flying hours, and George had to do all the flying and the navigating and everything, and in essence Ruth was just a passenger. Mm-hmm. But then of course that wasn't the story that was given to the newspapers and carried by the newspapers.
They said that she had also flown the plane.
Most of the accounts of that time had Ruth as either the pilot or as the co-pilot, but most of them as the pilot.
All those articles I read from that day, the aviation, popular aviation, aeronautics, they really come down on her in a heavy way. Well, most of them sort of come down. How totally unnecessary that trip was.
It had been done.
Well, 1927, still hadn't been... Then Amelia did it in 1929. She got all that acclaim. That was 2 years later, right? The passenger, that was the first woman across the Atlantic.
Well, let me see. I think it was in... when they went over in the Friendship.
29, right?
No. Wasn't it earlier than that?
No. Well, I know Ruth Elders was before. But they were saying, I guess, that it just didn't, you know, what was the...
Yeah, but you see, Ruth wasn't a woman solo thing.
Yeah.
Amelia made the...
Right,
because Amelia usually managed somehow to get ahead. But like you... It took dedication and the courage to accept defeat after defeat after defeat on your way to up the ladder to accomplishing what it was you wanted to accomplish. It took tenacity and stick-to-itiveness and willpower and disappointments. You just went through the entire gamut of not nice things that took a great deal of, it took more courage to overcome all of those things than it did to do the flying.
Mm-hmm.
The flying part didn't take much courage. It was the courage. The courage came in the effort to bring those things to fruition.
Did you, when you first started out in aviation, did you think that you would have the kind of career you couldn't have seen it?
I was firmly convinced I would.
Oh, you were?
Yes.
You did? That's interesting. So you knew that you were going to go out and compete. You were going to do that, compete and cross the records. And...
Aviation was my career, and I knew that if I gave it the best I had and tried hard enough, that I would make a success of it. I mean, it's a perfectly normal feeling. You have the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know that if you're dedicated, if you give it everything you have, that eventually you're going to accomplish what your goals. Mm-hmm. And it's no different in the way we felt, or the way women feel now, who are trying to and are beginning to crack the airline industry. Mm-hmm. The ones who are getting into the air services, I don't think feel that way, because they haven't had the struggle that it took, because it was handed to them, but not so with airlines. Mm-hmm.
You know, you must have, when you were out there competing, flying in, the men pals are doing their things, and you were sometimes breaking their records, for you, meaning you in general, women in general, you were doing your best and excelling. Must have given you a sense of your own equality, equality with men. You must have had a feeling of that, equality with men. And yet, which must have been a conflict also with the feelings of inequality with men. I mean, if there were, you were living in a time when women were not equal, and when women were taking a subservient place.
Well,
what did you think
I don't
about
know
it?
How, in general, how women pilots felt about that, but I do know that I didn't feel that way. Mm-hmm. And the women pilots who were closest to me did not feel that way. You didn't think about it. You knew that you could fly as well as any man could fly.
But did that give you a feeling of your equality with men? You know, for a long time, you know, the struggle that we're going through now, women are going through, they really, it's a spiritual and psychological struggle to feel equal. Don't you feel that they have to play a role in?
Well, we knew that the men looked down on us, that they did not give us credit for the abilities we had, or our potential capabilities, given the experience.
When you say the men,
we
you
knew
mean
that.
Pilots.
Yeah, but we. It was something you just didn't you didn't think about. You knew what you could do, and you knew what you were capable of doing. Mm-hmm. If you could just get the experience to do it. And the frustrations came in the difficulty of getting the experience,
which was related to the fact that you
to the number of hours you flew, which was the experience. And if you didn't have a lot of money, which most of us didn't, it meant having another job, or if you were very lucky, getting into an aviation company where you could trade your work for flying time. And that was the restrictive part of getting experience in the early days. The Harriet Quimbys and the Marjorie Catherine Stinsons and the Matilda Mossops back in those times, that wasn't a problem with them.
Because they had money?
Because they either had money or it was so new that sponsors were very easy to get to see that you got flight training and the rest of it. And the aircraft manufacturers, the ones who had the airplanes, solicited women, really, because it got them into the forefront immediately.
Like Blanche found a cord yesterday. Blanche Stewart's gone on one side of the plane. The aviation companies, they come fly with us, you know, mm-hmm. come and take lessons with us. Fly one of our planes is Blanche Stewart's guy who we've taught to fly in one of our aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But where did the conflict come in? I mean, there was some conflict. The men helped you.
Well, the conflict was that there was such a surplus of men pilots because of the World War I thing that all of the pilots couldn't find piloting jobs, and the ones who did have them were hanging on to them desperately, and naturally they resented, and you can't blame them, an upstart female coming in there and trying to maybe take their job away from them. And it was a normal reaction, and one that was appreciated, I think, by most women. But in a way, we weren't trying to take their jobs away from them.
You're just trying to...
In a way. Not that anybody would have turned down the opportunity, but it wasn't as competitive as they thought it was.
I told you, George Dade, I said, so what did the men think of those women then? I told you. Maybe I better not tell you. No, he said, this is how I think a lot of the male pilots said, how'd you feel those women out there competing with you and doing, you know, as good a job and winning the men's records? I mean, what did the men think about that? He said, well, no, look, he said, a lot of us women, I mean, we treat them like one of the guys. He said, they look masculine and they acted masculine. He said, and they had, you know, a masculine kind of appearance. He said, they were just like one of the boys. It wasn't like, you know, you were... I didn't say anything to him because I didn't want to, I wanted to fish interview, and I could have said quite a lot about that, but I thought it was funny that this is kind of the way the men, they satisfy themselves with that, you know, feeling that the women were so beautiful. When you just look at the women, Claudia Oakes and I were talking about it, those women were gorgeous. Not only were they great pilots and doing all this stuff, but they were beautiful, like you and Betty Hartley Gillies, and Amelia was attractive. I mean, that was... I think it was an interesting comment, and he's the second person, to me was man, said the same thing, the second person to sort of say that.
Well, I think it was true that there was an esprit de corps among pilots. You didn't think about sex, whether it was a male pilot or a female pilot. If you were a pilot, there was a very definitely a strong esprit de corps among pilots. That was beautiful. And you never were a stranger. You could fly into a field you'd never been in before, and the pilot or pilots on the field, I mean, you were just... It was like a long-lost brother. You were immediately, had a friendship there. Mm-hmm. And everybody helped everybody, and it was... And if you didn't know the guy on the field, he knew someone you knew. And it was a fraternity. And it was that way up until War II.
Do you think we put in the synopsis that because women, you know, you all, even if you weren't afraid, you knew that you might possibly not come back from any of your races, your records. I mean, there's always a chance, certainly hundreds of people lost their lives or were in serious accidents.
Well, but you never thought about
it. But that didn't give you, that didn't add to a solidarity, feeling of solidarity.
No, I don't think so. It was just simply a commonality of interest that was different from most other people's. Mm-hmm. plus the fact that, well, as you said in your synopsis there, we had experienced a something that no one who was not a pilot had ever experienced. And it set you apart. Because their flight and flying, even to the most, the toughest, most hard-bitten man pilot around, becomes subtly imbued with. And it does something to the strengthening of the spirit. Very subtly, and it just builds and builds the more you fly, and the more experience you have in the air, and it does set you apart.
That's a lovely way of putting it. That's really
wonderful. And I think that's one reason why there was the esprit de corps, the very high esprit de corps there was. It isn't true today, because everything is different. But it was then, because you were a relatively small group of people. You were pioneers, really. And it's too bad that is lost. Because the new breed of pilot learns to... They don't really learn to fly, most of them. They just learn how to drive. They're enclosed like a car. And you don't, you just don't get the same feeling.
I could see that when I saw that plane. When I saw this plane up close, and when the man was explaining, you know, how you just, I could just picture you then as travel there when you're getting ready to land. I don't think I remember seeing a picture of you like that. Looking out the side, I mean, you didn't see the runway, so you had to figure out, well, you know better than me, but I was just fascinated with that, and I realized what that really, really was to fly. Then. I mean, that was
in an open cockpit, you look up, then there's nothing obstructing you. The flying wires hum, the motor roars, and
there's so many things with the human.
This is the freedom of a bird, and it's a totally different sensation than being cooped up in a cabin. You don't get it. You, at night, when you fly at night, you don't feel as though you could reach up and get hold of a star.
Did you?
And you don't feel the presence. You don't feel a presence.
You must have, having this close association with one another, you must have felt it keenly then when one of you did die, when there was an accident, one of you was lost. Marble crossing. I don't know why that. That's really, I always feel touched when I read about, you know, the accounts of her death.
Well, whether it was a man or a woman. And again, I think it can be attributed to that subtle philosophy that we picked up from the man in being fatalist. Mm-hmm. You knew that people were going to die. And when they did, you were saddened by the loss of the person, but in no way did it affect your feeling about flying. No, in no way at all. You just accepted the fact that it had happened and continued as you had before.
Stella Wolf Murray wrote one of our, you know, Stella Wolf Murray, she's an English aviator. She wrote a book with Lady Mary Heath on women flying. And she said she couldn't understand why the American women nephews were doing all those feats and stunts, and it was really, it gained them a lot of publicity, but she didn't think that it furthered the cause of aviation, or women in aviation promoted it, you know. And so I wanted to ask you how you felt about that, and what,
well, I mean, one person's opinion.
When you read about being up in a plane for 8 days, my God, in that small space, we were looking at the Robin, the Curtis Robin at Viola Gentry, where she didn't stay very long on that, but it's just, for 8 days you stay up in a plane with Francis, what was Francis's name? Francis Marcellus.
Marcellus.
What was the other name, the middle name, Francis?
Harold.
I'll look into Harold. And staying up for 8 days in a plane. Why did you do these things? I mean, how did you feel about doing them, and why did you do them? They were a necessary part of developing aviation, I guess.
Well, primarily, it was to see how long engines would, and the adjuncts there too, would function on straightaway.
Would you approach one of these, the endurance racers' records, with enthusiasm doing it, or did you?
I did at the time. That's one of those things that it's more fun when you look back on it 2 or 3 years later than in the doing.
Oh, sure. It must have been incredibly difficult to even sleep. And
it wasn't as difficult as it was so boring.
Yeah.
It was monotonous.
How did you sleep? I mean, how could you rest in the back of the plane?
Well, fortunately, we had a large enough airplane, which was larger than the Curtis Robin. It was normally a six-place airplane, so we could sort of stretch it out. But it was very difficult to sleep. We had air mattresses, but I said in the book, those got punctured the second day up. And you got so you couldn't fly very long at a time without falling asleep or thinking you were going to. We started out flying in 4-hour shifts, and those kept getting shorter and shorter.
Would fly around the airport? Was that it?
Just fly around Long Island, and we had to check back over the airport every hour at a low altitude so the official observer could see us.
Could you now, when you had to be refueled, or these times when you had to be refueled, what when there would be bad weather, as there was with Viola, and then fogs, or was there any fog or anything that...
Well, yeah, we had one time during hours when it was touch and go. Casey Jones, the guy who was really running the flight, had told us that if bad weather did set in, that the refueler would come up and get us and lead us to where it was good weather, and they would take the NAA observer over there, and we'd just fly where it was good until it cleared up over Long Island again. So we had this, they sent up a note in the bucket that some bad weather was coming in, and but it was just going to be very short-lived, and we could run it out. And then the refueler came up, and it was terribly overcast with just a few little holes. So he led us up through a hole, and we refueled on top of the clouds in the evening. And I was worried sick for fear that hole would close up and we'd get out over the ocean or someplace and, you know, couldn't get back down again. Because there wasn't such a thing as instrument flying then.
And you wouldn't have known where to, I mean, if you couldn't see, then you wouldn't know.
But the hole stayed open and we got back down, and that night, all that night, it poured rain. It poured. And the visibility got so bad that we had to fly with one wing practically on the ground and circling the boundary lights of the airport, because that was the only reference we had. You know, you couldn't, we would have had to have landed otherwise. And that was a night that really took a lot out of us. And there was on one side of the airport, there was a real tall brick chimney, and we were below the level of that brick chimney.
So at any time you could sort of, did you ever think at any moment of landing, or did you?
No,
you just kept right.
Never occurred to us.
She was a good pilot too, friend.
Yes.
Cecilia, yeah. I was reading about her. So I liked her.
So that night we got to where we were flying 1 hour ticks.
That must have been tough. When the end of the 8 days, oh God.
Well, I counted, and it took a minute and a half to make a circle of the airport. So you know how many circles of the airport we made in about 12 hours.
Did you think everything about doing it again after it, to try a bigger endurance?
Never.
No, that was it.
Once was
enough.
I can imagine
that was the one at a time.
As a matter of fact, we made an abortive attempt. We'd been up...
2 days, that was
it. Yeah, we lost 18 hours because the rope on that bucket, you know, caught the wing and pulled the wingtip off. And Francis and I both knew then, when we got down, we didn't want to go back up again. We had thought it'd be fun until we had that 18-hour taste. But, Meg, come over here, boy. Come on.
That is a big, another one.
Meg is almost blind.
Oh.
Meg, come over here, boy. Come on. Come on. Lay down. Sit.
It's a beautiful dog.
Yeah, he is. Lay down, boy. Lay down. Lay down. Lay down. I said in the book they called us a flying boudoir, and one of the reasons they did was that we had a demountable toilet. The man had a catwalk that was around one side of the engine that they had to use to grease rocker arms, go outside to grease rocker arms and change oil, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. So when they had to go to the John, they just went out on the catwalk.
Yeah.
Well, the engineer who fixed up our airplane was a very innovative soul, and he figured out a system so that we could grease the rocker arms and change the oil from the cockpit. We didn't, from the cabin, we didn't have to go outside to do it. Mm. So he also rigged up this demountable John for us that was back toward the rear of the cabin, and on one side by a window. The thing had four windows in it. And there was a hole on the floor that had a cap over it, and when one of us had to use it, we just simply put this cap off and took the toilet. It was just a large pipe that had a toilet seat on it, and jammed it down in the hole. And then we had some large paper bags that were wax lined that we put down in there, and answered the call of nature. And then when we got through, we flew out over the ocean and just gave the bag a push, and then suction just pulled it out again.
Oh, that's terrific.
And then just took the John and put it back on the extra gas tank and covered over the hole, and we had the whole cabin free again. Well, any number of times when one or the other of us were on the John, people in other airplanes always were coming up and flying alongside, you know, to say hi. And they'd wave, and we'd wave back. But the really funny part of it was that after about 6 days, we got tired flying out over the ocean to dump the paper bag. And between, not very far from the airport, there was a whole lot of marshland. And we thought, well, why don't we just fly over the marsh and dump the bags? So we did that all one day. And the next morning, in the bucket that brought up our breakfast and things, there was a note on top of it from Casey Jones, and it was very terse. It said, "For God's sake, resume flying over the ocean, everybody on Long Island going around under umbrellas." As bombers, we weren't very expert.
You hadn't managed to get it down over the marshland. Oh, that is funny. That is great. And, you know, that's the question that people sort of wonder when they think that's dangerous.
Always,
8 days.
Yeah.
That certainly does come to one's mind. Well, how did you manage?
If I were writing the book today, I would have put that in, but not in 1938.
No,
you didn't dare.
No. Well, these are the kinds of things that Robin would, I mean, just that kind of, he was talking about. You know, in the 1930s, even when you read Heroines of the Sky, there's an attitude to writing. And
well, you know,
it
was a real problem on real long flights for women.
When you had to go through the shore, when you were racing even the Paddock Derby?
Well, no, not that, because our laps were very short, but like a lot of Amelia's flights, for instance. It was a real problem.
Did they provide something in the plane when she would, I mean, they would, suppose when you had to go across the Atlantic, when she went across the Atlantic, did they provide something in the plane? So that,
yeah, she had special gear. Of course, for a man, it's simple. All
sure.
You need is a bottle or right. Whatever, but...
And you have to get up and leave the controls or something for him.
Well, and you can't do that. Well, if you have an autopilot, you can, which...
Well, that's right, you can't do that.
Yeah. But you don't dare leave the controls, but it does let you be able to raise up, and you have a special flying seat with a zipper,
mm-hmm.
and be able to take care of yourself.
No, that's a question that people wonder how you manage it. Many people ask me.
Oh, man, man had it made.
Well, we were, you know, you see, Viola was telling us, and we put this in the books about this, that when she went up for her endurance flight, she was going to go with Ashley, that Ashley, I think it got killed. That was in Ashford.
I don't remember.
Guy who got killed. That people...
You don't turn this off again.
Yeah. That people were...
Because my children were an age where they needed a full-time mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it has always been my philosophy that when I got married... and we decided to have children, that was going to be my career. You shouldn't get married unless marriage is going to be your career. It's a career in itself if you're going to make the success of it.
If you're going to have children.
If you're going to have children. So the year before the war, I had, the children were at an age where they needed a full-time mother, so I took relegated aviation to an avocation rather than a vocation. So when this telegram came from the War Department, I didn't even have to think twice that no, I'm not going. I would love to have.
Yeah.
It was a challenge and something new, and you could contribute to your country, but for the exactly the same reason that I had given up my love, I didn't. And I've never regretted not doing it, as I've never regretted giving up aviation as a vocation. And I think you can see why when you look at Pat and our son Bill is equally as nice a person. That's the greatest contribution a woman can make, I think, if she can produce two outstanding children. So I missed that.
Well, but also it was nice that you had to a career where a lot of women don't experience that. I mean, you had the joys of raising your children and having wonderful children that turned out well. And also you had a career, you had that time in aviation. Most women don't ever get, well, today they do, I mean, they will more, but they don't, haven't had that opportunity to feel that fullness in life, you know, the satisfaction of having done something well themselves. And then being able to sit down and raise their children, sit down and raise their children. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, that feeling you really achieve something.
It's a full-time job, and if you don't take it as a full-time job, then you're not going to be successful with it.
The aviation?
Either in a marriage or in raising children or anything else you're attending.
I think that if you had, with today's attitudes, you might do an aviation career and be a mother at the same time, perhaps you were raising children if things were. We had this attitude, present-day attitude, that you might be working and raising your children at the same time, or anything like that.
Well, I don't think so. You're constituted the way you're constituted, and you have certain requisites and certain goals and certain standards, and try to maintain them.
What was Nancy Rupp's career before she became temporarily head of the watch? What was she doing?
Well, Nancy was in aviation too. She got herself various jobs with several different aircraft manufacturers demonstrating. And when she married, her husband also was a pilot and aviation connected. Mm-hmm. And they had no children at the time. And it was a natural for Nancy. Betty Gillies did have children at the time.
She's really something, Betty.
Oh, she is the nicest person.
She's really.
And I wish she could have known Nancy Love. She's just as nice.
I'm anxious to meet Betty. She's a little bit aloof, Betty. No, she's not so much anymore now that she's gotten accustomed to me.
A little.
I forced her into relating to me on a more personal level.
Betty isn't very outgoing. But once you get the shell open,
she came from a lot of money, though, and mm-hmm. That's what she was able to do. In aviation. She do some test piloting. Well, I'll find out from her. Well, basically, I want to find out, though, before I go to California, just want to ask you to get this straight. So then Jackie Cochran then became head of the WASPs, and that's certain Nancy Love was there for a year
well,
or
Betty,
two. Or
Betty can fill you in on all that.
Yeah. I just didn't want to go and seem, I wanted to know a little bit about it before I went. And, well, that helps me, if, you know, mm-hmm. straighten out as mm-hmm. to know I can. That was too bad. Yeah. Although she must have done a good job, Jackie.
I don't think she did particularly.
No. Well,
she was too busy.
Well, we won't quote you.
She was too busy being the head of the WASPs and trying to euchre the Air Corps into letting her fly bombers and letting her do this and that. That was. They weren't letting any of the other WASPs do. our government, that the Germans had built up this tremendous military force, mm-hmm. including an air force, which according to the treaty they were not supposed to do. And that they were better equipped than any other country to fight a war, and that they were going to go to war. And apparently the powers that be just totally ignored his report and sort of poo-pooed it, and he didn't know what he was talking about and all the rest of it. And so that is when he went out to the before the public to tell them that Germany was preparing for war and had the materiel to fight one, and nobody else did. And he thought that we, when they started overrunning Europe, that we should stay out of it. That was his opinion at the time. So that's when everybody started calling him an isolationist, because he wanted us to keep a hands-off policy. But then as soon as the war started, he worked with our Air Corps as a civilian, unpaid, and did more, contributed more to the war effort than I think any one individual in the whole country. He made improvements on our pursuits and our bombers and in techniques. He flew missions. He made a tremendous contribution to the war. And all of it very inconspicuously, and he didn't want any publicity on it, and was given none, and a lot of people don't know
about it. What come out?
What he did. But it's always made me so mad, because he was sent over there on a mission to
find... But people know that he was sent on a spy mission in the natural country.
Well, it's pretty obvious.
But there still seems to be, you know, that condemnation of Lindbergh.
And the Germans were gracious, I think, and gave him a medal or something, and which he accepted graciously. I mean, what can you do?
Sure.
And he was criticized very severely for that.
What about Anne Lindbergh? She flew on a lot of his missions. She was also a pilot. I mean, did she ever do anything by herself? Most of the things she did was with
him? No, I don't think she had ever had any desire to. It's my opinion that she didn't learn to fly simply because he wanted her to.
And she could go.
I don't think she had any real interest in it, except just because he did it.
Who are some of the outstanding foreign aviators besides Teresh? Rush? However you pronounce it.
There are quite a few. Of course, Lady Mary Heath before
her. I like her.
And then there was Amy Johnson Mollison, who did wonderful things.
Yeah.
And then more recently, Sheila Scott.
When you say more recently, you should have got, when was that, when is the movie, what's more recently?
And she's done round the world things and flown over both poles and solo in a single engine airplane.
That wasn't any time when you were flying, lately in the 60s?
No, this is the new crop. No, that's been within the last
Were there any French women aviators flying with you women? Were there any Were there any well-known French women flying at the same time with you? Can you remember?
Yeah, there was one gal who Well, a little later on, after War II, whose father was...
Jacqueline Oriol.
Like that.
But nobody contemporary with you, that you can think of?
Not that I can recall. The from the mid-20s to through the 30s, it seemed to be pretty well dominated by U.S. women.
Oh, Tia Rush and Hannah Rush. There's nothing on Hannah Rush, either the symphony or...
I don't think they even are related.
But they have the same, yeah, but I found a newspaper article saying that Tia Rush was cleared of a denazification trial or investigation, or she was cleared of any Nazi activity. Well, I wondered why they even held that. I mean, after all, that was her government. If she was in Germany, why would you be condemned for partaking in your, you know...
Well, I don't know, unless it was that she had flown in the United States. So.
Oh.
She was in the first women's air derby.
Yeah.
And then she used to come back here rather frequently.
She was well-liked, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Who was head of Hitler's women pilots? That was Hannah?
Well,
must
if there
have been,
was
if
somebody,
she,
the head of it...
Had to have been, if she was clear
yeah,
of any...
Wasn't.
Of,
it wasn't Thea.
Thea. And after she, so after the war, she wasn't. Was that it for her? I was just wondering if that finished up. But she did. She do set a lot of records. Was she really a big competitor here in this country in Germany?
I don't think she set any records. None that I recall. I think she, at the time, was either the only woman pilot in Germany or one of very few. Just weren't very many.
Investigation, because I've been looking, you know, trying to find these. I assumed that they were French women.
Like in England, early on, there were, you know, just very few women.
Well, it was there was Lady Mary Heath in Bailey, and Kate by George on her, if I remember her name. And Stella Wolf Murray and Amy Johnson, those were the four.
Yeah. And I think there was a Beryl Markham.
Oh, she was English.
Like
was
that.
English?
Is she English?
I looked, there is something there.
Or Australian or something.
So I probably have all the best women pilots in my... Mm-hmm. And I think I probably, there weren't any French women that I'm missing, and there weren't more German women. Or Belly, Beinhorn. Ellie
Beinhorn.
Beinhorn.
Mm-hmm.
She did watch it.
She came later on.
Later on in the 40s, or
mm-hmm.
was around that time?
Mm-hmm. After War II, I think.
Maybe.
I wouldn't swear
maybe
to.
A little before that. There's just so many things I want to ask you.
Did your aspirin work? Would you like another one?
How did you know I was that young?
Oh, one of the intuition.
I know, I left it, I think it's in the kitchen.
Do you know where it is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing.
An international aviation organization called the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, which was headquartered in France, to sanction and supervise balloon records. Then when airplanes came along, it did the same thing for airplanes. And then when airplanes got more, there were more of them in all the countries, then they established in each country a branch of the Federal Aviation Aeronautic International. And over here it was the National Aeronautic, well, it started out as the Aero Club of America and then became the National Aeronautic Association. And there was a period in the late 20s when Russia was grabbing off all the airplane records.
Went into?
Because
you told me with Eleanor, remember that time on the phone?
Yeah.
You said that
Russia and France.
Well, but you said you were saying Russian and French women had government aircraft to fly. What French women were flying as government aircraft?
I don't know. Anyway, the National Aeronautic Association over here sent out an SOS and said, please, we have to get back a bunch of records and establish new ones. So that was kind of a catalyst that stimulated so much record flying during that time.
That's interesting.
And so anytime anybody can make a record, hooray!
When did that, about what year did that happen?
Oh, it started about in the late 20s.
Uh-huh. That was in about 1927, 26, 27, competitive flying really seemed to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
And it
well,
really got, that was it.
That was the reason.
Oh, I see. There was a lot of things about the national air races and the air circuses and the barnstorming that I wanted to ask you. Do you remember any of the big promoters of the air races and the barnstorming and characters that were the men that were behind this? Do you remember any of them?
Civilian.
Yeah, who owned these?
Well, I think the. As far as racing is concerned, definitely Cliff Henderson, Clifford W. Henderson, and his brother, but primarily Cliff, was. Get hold of him. They're away quite a bit, but if you catch him at home, he loves to talk.
Good.
And, you can have a very interesting conversation.
Oh, I'm sure. I bet I could. I wonder if he's listed in front of me.
Oh, I'm sure he is.
Sure
in fact, he's the one who established Palm Desert.
So he was one of the foremost promoters of the air races.
Definitely. And it was the national air races is what got all the racing started and continued. The first one was in 1928 in Los Angeles. And they had them every year until the war stopped them. And they were just fabulous and drew tremendous crowds. And it was one of the reasons why this country got so far ahead of other countries in airplane design, because in racing you just did all kinds of things to make airplanes go faster.
Mm-hmm.
And then these were picked up and incorporated into commercial aircraft a great deal. like the old Indianapolis 500 used to be the automobiles. Yeah, that's what the national air races were, the airplanes.
And like the Derby, the Dixie Derbies and things like that. Mm-hmm.
They were proving grounds. And,
some of these guys must have been real characters who organized these things.
Oh, if they were anything like Cliff, they are. And Cliff is just a lovely gentleman. He's just the peach of a guy.
Well, I'll write him anyway. Maybe I'll have to make a move. I'm just kind of corny. I'll have to get that. So, or maybe even Robin can go and interview him. I'm sure he'd have a lot to tell
you. Oh, yeah.
Did you ever do any Barnstorming?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't. You just right away got the story. Well, then that was Pete.
The closest I got to it, we used to haul passengers on weekends.
Yeah.
And everybody used to flock to the airports, especially on Sunday, to see the airplanes.
Is that part of how you made some of your money?
Mm-hmm.
So to go back, so Cliff Henderson and his brother, they organized the air races. There's, mm-hmm. there's one, then one
national. The national
air
races.
Was there more than one big air race per year, or just that one? Huh?
Mm-hmm.
When they say air circuses, what does that refer to?
Well, that was during the barnstorming days, and it simply meant that there were three or four airplanes and pilots, you know, together, mm-hmm. with wing walking and parachute jumps and that kind of thing. It was just a bunch of barnstormers together who would attract, you know, more of a crowd, and they usually would concentrate on the county fairs they used to have in those days, mm-hmm. and, you know, where a crowd would be, or just go into a town and find a pasture on the outskirts and do a little advertising, bollywooding.
Like a carnival. Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet Bessie Coleman? I probably found some stuff on her, too.
Who?
Bessie Coleman, the black woman aviator who went killed. So air circuses were, you know, involved in barnstorming. Okay. And some of them were pretty fabulous. You must have been.
Well, in as much as they were very daredevil-y, they were.
You must have wanted to promote women too, because that.
Well, a lot of the, well, not a lot, but. There were women who did wing walking and parachute jumping, although there weren't any that I know of who flew in the air circuses.
Mm. The newspaper people, do you remember any of the big journalists that would write about pro and con, that were writing about the women that you remember in particular, who were really a bit of bastards, or who were, you know, helped you, or who were favorable to you?
Yeah, well, there were some of both kinds.
Yeah, and that's what we were.
But I can't recall offhand any of the ones who were pro and any of the ones who were con.
I got a big kick out of that one article you sent me, Amanda.
There were more cons than pros, though. I do remember that.
There were more cons than pros. I remember that article that you sent me in the air derby, that guy was writing about the women's air derby and why, and the patronizing terms in which he wrote about women's participation in the women's air derby. I saw that draw on my friends. They liked yeah, luckily there are articles left where I can get that, but I just wanted the names of some journalists that we might be able to quote and that we might
no,
be able
I
to.
Wish I could remember.
But maybe there'll be somebody who will remember that. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff is lost. But the women's air derby got a lot of bad press because of Marvel Crossman's death.
Well, Cliff, again, was responsible, really, for getting that first women's air derby. It was fortunate that he believed that a good woman pilot was as good as a good man pilot.
Mm.
And Cliff, naturally, is definitely the promoter type, or he wouldn't have done what he did. And he could see the advantage to his national air races of having women participants. So he got the National Exchange Clubs to put up the prize money for this first National Women's Air Derby that was held in 1929, which was the second year of the National Air Races. And he sure guessed good. They had an exactly the same race for men, but we started in Santa Monica, and the men started in Portland, Oregon, and flew into Cleveland. And we started from Santa Monica and flew into Cleveland. And the Women's Derby was front page all across the way, and the men's were buried back in the advertisement somewhere. And after the race was finished, I saw a newspaper clipping when I was writing that piece for Aviation Quarterly. The newspaper guys who were covering the races said that the Women's Air Derby was by far the most outstanding event of the National Air Races.
Oh, that's terrific.
Including all the closed course and everything.
And why was that? Because the women were so...
Because it was a bunch of women competing for the first time. And it never had been done before. Mm-hmm. It was a first. And the public was tremendously interested in aviation at that time because of the stimulus that Lindbergh had given. So here were a bunch of women flying cross-country in a race, and it just took the public, the public just ate it up.
Yeah,
and the crowds at all the airports where we stopped were just simply tremendous.
You came in first all along the way? How many days did the race take?
Oh, I've forgotten. I think it says in that Aviation Quarterly piece, I think it was about 6 or 7. You see, it was a control race, which is why the crowds were so big. We knew ahead, we had a stop for lunch, and then we had an overnight stop.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 days we had intermediate stops, but everybody knew where we were going to be at a certain time on a certain day. And they kept us bunched by the first person into the night stop was the last person off then when we took off the next morning. So, you know, it kind of evened out.
Mm-hmm.
And at any one stop, all the airplanes would be in within about an hour's period of time.
You led the way in one race.
No, I think it was the second day out. I got into the lead and then held it. It says in that piece in Aviation Quarterly.
Were you surprised you won? It must have been thrilling to win that.
It was. It was. It was a lot more thrilling than the Bendix.
It was? Why? I would have thought the Bendix would have been.
Well, the Bendix was a very impersonal thing. At least it seemed like it was to me, having been in the Women's Derby, where you got to know everybody well,
yeah,
because of the length of time, and you had a kind of a camaraderie that developed, and. in the Bendix that everybody was rushing around on his own little do, trying to get ready to go, and I never did see any of the contestants even until we had a weather briefing, and then not all of them then, because some of them had their own private weather service. So, and then you took off and just flew until you got to where you were going.
That must have been a lot of, did you encounter a lot of jealousy of having won Bendix and